This season's extreme weather has really been a challenge for folks for a variety of reasons, and keeping our gardens alive is a big one. Whether it's veggies, flowers, or those lovely shade trees, they all need extra doses of water from us since in most of the state, nature is not cooperating. Barb Larson is a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. She has a wealth of information to share, and we're always happy when she can join us on Garden Talk. Barb, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, as we were saying, it's been so incredibly dry. I can't even remember the last time we got rain in the Madison area, and there's nothing in the forecast. I mean, how much stress is that putting plants under?
It puts them under a tremendous amount of stress. And then on top of the drought, we have the extreme high temperatures. If we had one or the other,
right,
it would be better when we have them.
If it was cool
together.
And dry, yeah, it might not be quite so bad.
Not quite as bad. And then on top of everything else, it's been very windy most of the time, which dries the plants out even further. So I think we really have to, at this point, start thinking about what are important plants in the landscape and what are the ones we're really going to concentrate on watering and trying to keep alive.
And how do you make that decision? I mean, I'm guessing that, you know, it makes sense to prioritize perennials over annuals, since annuals are only going to be around this year anyway. But how do you make those kind of decisions?
You know, that's how I would prioritize it. And I always prioritize things like trees and shrubs first. You cannot replace even a 40-year-old tree. So I would look at those needed first. Interestingly, I had a colleague that put lawn second. I would not put lawn second. Mm. And I think a lot of gardeners wouldn't do that. But if you think about it economically, to replace a lawn is probably more expensive than some of the other things. Although I encourage people to let the lawns go dormant, meaning they're going to turn that yellow straw color, and then only watering just enough. And that would be a quarter to a half an inch about every 4 weeks or so.
Oh, okay. That's not that much.
Yeah, just to keep them, the roots hydrated.
So not worry really about the part we're seeing. And a lot of people have been saying, you know, walking across their lawn is like walking on Rice Krispies now.
Yeah.
But thinking more about the kind of the minimum that root system needs.
Yeah, just enough to keep the roots and the crowns hydrated, but not bring them back into active growth again. We don't want them to green up. So that's kind of a little bit tricky, and it depends on where you are and how dry your soil is, and, you know, some of those kinds of things as to how often you do it. So
now let's go back to the trees and shrubs, because that's actually come up quite a bit in the last few weeks on Garden Talk. And I have to say, it's not necessarily something I think about right away. I mean, I tend to think of trees as, you know, they just kind of keep going regardless of what's happening. And we're used to thinking of them as being really hardy because obviously they make it through our winters. But we've been hearing more and more this year that, you know, we're getting to the point in much of the state that the trees are really hurting. How do we know, first of all, how much a tree needs to be watered, and where do we water? I mean, because there's the tree, there's what we see. But the root system is much wider than that. What is there an optimal area to water?
Well, usually we're not going to be watering the entire root system, because the root span for a tree is about sometimes 3 up to 5 times the height of the tree.
Wow.
But remember that the roots are only, most of the feeder roots are all in that top 2 feet of soil. So the top 2 feet of soil are dry. They're not going down to China someplace to get water. So that's why we need to think about watering them. So what I tell most people is thinking about watering under the canopy of the tree and maybe a little bit past. At least that's going to, what we're doing is we're not providing all the water they need, but we're kind of limping them through the best we can. Now, there are formulas that you can use to figure out how many gallons to put on and all those kinds of things. But I like a trick that a nursery person told me a few years ago, and that is to water half an hour, whatever. I use a sprinkler, either on low, a soaker hose, underneath the canopy, not just at the trunk, and let it run for a while and let it soak in. Then I take either a bamboo stick, or you can use a coat hanger that's straightened out, anything long and narrow. I push it into that wet soil. When I get resistance, that's the dry soil. I can pull it out and see how far down I've got it wet. It's just a really easy way to do it.
And you said that those roots that we're trying to get the water to are in the top 2 feet.
In the top 2 feet of soil. So I always figure with trees, if I can get it wet down below 4 inches, so, you know, that 6 to 8 inch or something like that, then I'm in really good shape. If I leave it up above that, then it's probably the grass is going to take most of it. So we need to get it below there. So I have green grass underneath my trees.
and everything else
is brown.
So in general for watering, is there a better time of the day to water? And does it depend what you're watering?
Best time of day is, if we're watering at the ground level, so which is where we recommend to reduce diseases, then it's not a real big deal, except that if you're using a sprinkler in midday, it's going to evaporate more. So it's much better to do morning. Rising temperatures is the general. If you're going to wet it, the surface, like if you're doing a lawn, if you're doing perennials, anything like that, then in mornings are usually best.
Is there a risk when the sun is so strong, like it has been? I know that water can magnify the effects of the sun. Is there a risk of burning
some
foliage?
People see, and there are some plants that are probably a little more sensitive to that. But I think the main reason to avoid that midday is much more that you don't want evaporation on it.
Okay. So, we're talking with Barb Larson today on Garden Talk. She is a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, who is on the WPR Garden Tour of England. And I have to say, from the pictures that they've been sending us, much more moderate temperatures that they're enjoying in England, and they're seeing some amazingly beautiful gardens and flower shows. We'll have more photos up later today, but we have a bunch up on the Facebook page already. You can go there. You don't have to be a member of Facebook. Just search Facebook Larry Mueller Show, and it's M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Sometimes that's a tricky one, and Larry's so used to spelling it, he doesn't think of spelling it out. So M-E-I-L-L-E-R. You can see some great photos of the group that's on that WPR Garden Tour of England. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How has the extreme weather we've been dealing with affected your plants? And what differences are you seeing other than the dryness in your garden this year compared to other years? We'd love to hear from you.
Okay.
Yes. And
I see one already that came in that just is asking. She read an article in the Wisconsin, Tom, in the Wisconsin State Journal, and they wanted to know how often. And what I always recommend is if temperatures are above 90, especially if it's windy, about every 7 to 10 days for trees and shrubs, and you want that inch of water.
Okay.
Or, as I said, I prefer to just make sure I soak it down deep. If it's less than that, and hopefully it looks like maybe next week we'll go below 90, then you can get away with about every 10 days to 2 weeks.
Right. Well, it's I happily we don't deal with these stretches of weather this hot very often, but you know it means that we're not as prepared and aren't sure what to do.
Yeah, and the last time I remember anything like this was 1988 when we had a severe drought and we had a lot of browning and dieback in trees and lots of other things that really didn't make it through the summer. The problem this time is that it's occurring earlier and the temperatures are hotter. So. Mm-hmm. I mean, we really have to watch our plants this year.
And we do have a caller on the line, so let's go there. Cobb, who is calling from Cobb. Hi, Cobb.
Yeah, good afternoon. I got a little tip for planting tomatoes next year. I planted tomatoes this year, and I dug it. When I planted them, I kind of made a base, you know, like a bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put in mulch, you know, from 3 or 4 years ago that I had. Manure, you know, horse manure and cow manure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I took a handful of that, put that, made it kind of like a moat, you know, like a castle moat.
Okay.
And then let the water surround the plant. And then now I've been taking my holes and I got that, put the holes in that hole and then just soaks it in and about 5 minutes. And it's filled up to you can't take anymore. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So you use that moat to
hold the water in, right? And so it directs it down into the plant. Yes, that's fine.
In the plant, I got about 300 plants here, and I can get away with not watering for about 2 days, and then I got to go back to them because they start to shrivel the leaves,
yeah.
You know, fold right up.
Well, it's always best to water any of our plants less frequently but deeply. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure we have a deep root system on them, even in this kind of weather. So I always recommend that you know, kind of a quick sprinkle with the hose doesn't really do that much good.
Right.
We're better off watering about every 3 or 4 days and then making sure you get wet down a good 4 to 6 inches.
Really soak it in.
Yeah.
And actually, thanks for that tip, Cab. Cab brought up specifically tomato plants, and we know that those are heavy feeders to begin with. And then in weather like this, I'm thinking that tomatoes are really needing a lot of help right now.
Well, I think no more water than what we would be normally looking at. And in some ways, when the temperatures get really warm on some of these vegetables, especially warm nighttime temperatures, it actually affects the pollen. So we can get blossom drop. So you may see that your tomatoes, peppers, and sometimes some of your other vegetable plants, they're blooming, but they're not really producing fruits yet. And that would be expected when it's this warm. Now, next week, when it cools down, especially in the evenings, when we're talking about
relatively
60s,
speaking,
not, yeah, I know, isn't that awful when you think about that? They'll go back and everything will start growing again.
And what about containers? Because I know a lot of people like me have, you know, peppers, tomatoes, and containers. And containers you really have to keep an eye on for drying out.
Right.
Already.
Yeah. And in that case, you're just going to have to check them. The bigger containers are going to stay moist longer, but chances are those containers are going to have to be watered once or sometimes twice a day.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks for that call, Cub. And Annie in Janesville is next. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Good morning. I have a question about how to get the Japanese beetles to stop eating my runner bean leaves. And I wanted a non-chemical way.
Well, the best way I know to deal with Japanese beetles is go out in the early morning so they're cooler, and get a little, I use an ice cream container with soapy water in it, and I knock them off the plant and into the soapy water, and they drowned. Spraying them with soapy water doesn't work, so you're just going to have to knock them off the plant. It's really important with these first ones that come out to get those. And then after I've filled up my little container, I take them in and flush it all down the toilet. So that's really, that's the best way
the
to
manual,
yeah,
manual
is the
technique.
Manual way to do it.
Oh, okay, thank you. I do that, but I thought maybe there's something to use in between when I'm not out there guarding them.
Yeah, well, you know, it's if you're trying to keep the population down, they're going to do some damage, but odds are you're going to at least keep ahead of them, hopefully.
And maybe it'll be more cosmetic damage than
yes,
really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, thanks for that call, Annie. That brings me to a question, Barb. What kind of disease or pest reports have you been getting?
Very few disease reports because it's been so dry. So guess what? There's a good silver lining
there.
That's right. Interestingly, Japanese beetle reports are starting to come in now. So we expect them. The other ones I'm starting to get are earwigs. And most people think, well, wait a minute, it's too dry for earwigs. And I think it's because we're just seeing them more because they're congregating in the damp areas.
So
underneath a pot, you know, you pick it up and there's the earwigs or something like that. Those are the main ones I'm seeing.
And what damage do earwigs do?
Well, earwigs will eat a lot of leaves and flowers. They love marigolds, which of course proves disproves the marigolds repel bugs. I prefer to use like an earwig trap or something like that in order to get rid of them.
And we've been hearing a lot about flea beetles this year.
There have been, especially early on, we saw a lot of flea beetles, and that's a pretty typical one also in the warmer weather. In some of our gardens in Kenosha, we're also seeing a lot of cabbage worms. So, and what we do is, well, we got floating row cover over them, but some of them snuck in anyway. So
sneaky.
Yeah, sneaky.
Well, and I'm guessing
so we handpick those.
And I'm guessing cabbage worms, people might think, oh, I'm not growing cabbage, no problem. But I'm assuming they probably like all of those.
Anything
cruciferous
in the cabbage family, right?
So broccoli,
cauliflower, kohlrabi, Brussels sprouts. Yeah.
great. All right. Well, thanks for that call. You are listening to Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, visiting with Barb Larson, a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. Rachel Owens, our on-air producer today. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. Well, usually on Garden Talk, we talk about how to get the most out of our gardens and how to keep it thriving. It seems like this year the theme is more how to keep it alive than thriving. But you know, I think that we've got some good advice here. And Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County, has much more to share. So I hope you'll join us. You can leave a question, comment, or a garden photo on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Or you can email a comment or question to talk@WPR.org. And Sally in Hayward is next. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a wonderful 5-year-old full tall Joe Pye weed. It looks fine, except there are holes in the leaves. I know you were just talking about earwigs. Would earwigs be eating it?
I have no idea.
Okay.
You know what I always suggest to people? Well, first of all, Joe Pye is one of our native plants.
Right.
So in a native plant, there are going to be native insects that may be feeding on it, and that's just fine. One of the things I always recommend if you can't find an insect on there is go out about 10 o'clock at night with your flashlight and see if you see anything. But as long as they're not completely stripping it, if it's just holes in the leaves, I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay.
And I would say this is nature the way it should be.
And especially it sounds like that's a nice established plant, too.
Is.
So so probably the... If there's damage, it'll be more cosmetic.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's very reassuring.
I'm sure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good.
Thanks, Sally.
Thanks.
And actually, that reminds me, I think it's Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery says that, you know, if he goes out and, you know, they have amazing numbers of native plants and grasses, that in his own garden, if there isn't some insect, quote unquote, damage, then he doesn't think it's a very healthy ecosystem, that something's out of balance, because that's part of the purpose of those native plants is to feed the insects, which then feed the birds, which also pollinate, you know, so it's
and
a whole cycle.
And all those kinds of things. And so many people like butterflies and moths. If you want butterflies in your garden, you have to have caterpillars.
Yes.
And they're going to be eating your plants. So.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. So it's the circle of life.
That's
really.
Right.
Well, Robert in Kewanee has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Robert.
Good morning. Say, I have a question regarding rhubarb.
All right.
I've been told there is a plant called strawberry rhubarb. Is that accurate?
Yes, there is a plant called strawberry rhubarb.
I thought there was just a pie.
I believe it may be a cult, but other than that, I can't tell you. It's been years. I can't remember anything else about it.
Oh,
maybe somebody, I'm sure somebody, one of the listeners will know all about it, and they will either call or put something on the Facebook page.
Sounds good. I will listen.
All right. Okay. So is that rhubarb supposed to taste like both strawberry and rhubarb?
I think it was, if I remember correctly, and again, it's been years, so I could very well remember incorrectly. it had to do with the color of it.
Okay.
It was one of those nice kind of pinky red colors.
Ah, okay. Got it. So you probably still need sugar for your pie.
I would guess so.
It's so interesting that we have different themes that come up over growing seasons. Flea beetles has been one, watering trees has been one, and another has been purslane. And Lisa writes, my veggie and flower garden is covered in purslane. This is the first year that they've been so prolific. They're attractive, but out of control. So I'm thinking she's asking for advice on controlling it. But as we talked about, a lot of people eat it.
Yes, they do. And this has been perfect weather for purslane. It likes hot, dry conditions, and so it can outcompete everything else. It's an annual, so you can pull it up whether you eat it or not. The important thing is to prevent it from going to seed.
Okay.
So that you don't have that seed bank, you're not increasing the amount of seeds in the soil.
So as long as you can just pull it up yourself, it doesn't have a really hardy root system?
No, it doesn't have a huge root system.
Okay, so getting rid of it before it goes to seed should do the trick.
This is also another one of those where mulching may help cut down on it, because it'll help shade the soil and you get less of those weed seeds coming up.
We had another question about seeds. Is wisteria true to seed? Reva in Appleton says, my vine bloomed this year and is now covered with seed pods. Can I plant them and expect to get the same wisteria vines?
I think it depends on whether or not you have a cultivar or whether you have the species. So if you have something like this falls, which is a cultivar, then probably not. In fact, I'm sure it won't come back true. If you have something like Kentucky wisteria or just basic Chinese wisteria, it may come back.
Okay, so it's probably worth a try.
And you know what? There's genetic variation with seed, when you get seed. So you may find that it won't be exactly the same anyway. And I have to tell you, you are producing seed pods, so I think it should be a viable seed.
Okay.
And you may want to do a little research to see what kind of treatment it takes.
And going back to some bug questions, Gary asks on our Facebook page, ants, are they bad for tomato plants? I'm talking about the little brown ants.
The worst thing that ants do in a garden is that they make ant colonies. And mm-hmm. so they work up the soil, and where they work up the soil, they have air spaces, and that can sometimes damage the roots as they're in that air space.
But in general, they're not attacking
the plants.
In general,
they're not going to eat the plants or anything.
All right.
Although they may be a sign that you have aphids in there, and we've had lots of aphids this year.
Hmm. Everything seems to be extreme this year.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Judy in Madison is up next. Hi, Judy.
Hello. I'll first make a comment about the strawberry rhubarb.
Okay.
Oh, good.
Red in color, much drier than the normal rhubarb, so you don't get as much juice from it. Slower to bolt.
Ah, very good. Oh, I knew somebody.
There
would
you go. Wow,
remember.
that was fast.
That's great.
Thanks. And what's your question, Judy?
Well, I have a couple of them. The first one is about broccoli. My broccoli, which was planted early May, is beautiful. It is about 3 feet tall. It's nice in every way, except it has no broccoli.
So it's
I don't know if I should pull it and start over with something else, or continue to wait for some florets to form. I'm just unsure on what to do.
So you've got the stalk and leaves, but no florets.
No.
Yes.
Yeah. I actually thought you were going to tell me that it was bolting already, that the flowers, buds were gone, you know, it was already going to full flower, which is what we normally expect in these cooler season mm-hmm. crops when it gets really hot. I'm thinking it's probably still related to the heat, and I can't tell you whether or not it's going to actually at some point form flowers or not. I would, with everything this year, what I'm telling most people is just let's sit tight and see what happens.
Okay.
All right. Let me know.
The second question is about watering. In a normal summer, I only water the garden once a week and try to give it the full inch and a half of water.
Okay.
When it's hotter like this and the ground drying out, can you water more often?
Yeah, you can water more often. You may want to go to every 3 or 4 days, but kind of check and see. It sounds like you're a very good gardener, so you know how to kind of assess things. The one thing I would watch is look to see how the plants look in the morning, not in mid-afternoon, because a lot of plants will wilt in mid-afternoon, and once you go back at about 10 o'clock, 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, they perked back mm-hmm. up again because they've been able to take up enough moisture.
The wilt is almost a protective action.
Well, yeah, it's because they can't suck up enough water during midday. So So I would just kind of watch it. But, yes, you can do it more often.
Great. Thanks a lot. Mm-hmm.
Great. Thanks, Judy. Thank you. Good luck with that broccoli. I actually wondered if she was going the caterpillar, the cabbage worm.
Oh,
way too.
Could be.
But something totally different.
I've also seen in droughty years where birds will get in and eat the flowers out because they're so desperate for moisture.
Yeah. We were just talking about that on our bird watching show on Wednesday, mm-hmm. how important it is to get some water out there for the birds in extreme long times of dryness like this. Thanks for that call, Judy. And let's go to Bob in Madison. Hi, Bob.
Hi. The trick with getting water out for the birds is keeping the squirrels from knocking the bird bath over.
Yeah. Well, they might need a little cool off, too.
I'm sure they do. So, Judy, my question has to do with a rose bush, a large one. Back in mid-May, I dug it out and moved it to my yard and did it late evening and tried to make sure that I got it plenty of water. But it went into shock, and now it certainly looks dead. It's covered with brown leaves, but I've got a couple of neighbors who insist, oh, no, it'll come back next spring. Any thoughts on that?
I would scrape the bark a little bit, especially lower on the bush, and see if it's still green underneath the bark.
Okay.
And I'd look to see if you've got any buds that are still, you know, kind of soft, pliable. It looks like they're okay. If not, then it may not be alive. The other is, I doubt it, but it's if it is a shrub rose or one that's not grafted, I suppose there's a slight possibility that may come back from the root system.
Okay.
But right. I can't, you know, I think it's, this may be a wait and see. If it's completely dried up, I think you need to find something else.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bob. And let's go next to Elizabeth in Sister Bay. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I'm just commenting, adding to your, you know, your allegiance to having a good, healthy ecosystem. You know, I don't like cutworms or potato beetles either, and there are organic methods of dealing with those things. But in regard to the other kind of smaller compendium of little critters that are out there, I have an organic market garden, and I think that educating people is an important part of dealing with the fact that usually people don't want to see any little nibbles in their lettuce. However, I have a son-in-law from China. And his mother taught my daughter to shop at the market. And one of the important things she taught her was that they specifically seek out plants that have little signs of nibbles and signs that they've been stressed a little for two reasons. They indicate that this plant has not been, you know, covered in nasty pesticides. And they also indicate their belief is that they're more healthy. And now we have good research showing that both plants and medicine plants, food plants and medicine plants, are they have more of the good juju that we want from them because they excrete that when they're stressed.
Oh, so, interesting.
Yeah, little signs of stress and nibbles in your plant is a good thing.
Well, thank you so much for that, Elizabeth.
That's where little stress is good, a lot of stress not so good, just like with us.
But I think that, you know, that it, of course, makes sense, but I had never really put that together that, you know, obviously something hasn't been treated with heavy-duty chemicals if there were insects or whatever nearby.
And she's also right that we really need to change our American idea that perfection is what plants ought to look like, and it's not just our fruits and vegetables.
No.
It also has to do with flowers and other things, too. So.
I'll take taste over appearance
in
fruits and vegetables anytime. Thank you so much for that call, Elizabeth. We had a question on Facebook from Tracy in Dousman. My ferns, as well as other perennials, are dying back. Are they going dormant, or are they actually dying? Will they come back next year if I don't water them?
The ferns are going dormant. They really will. They like usually a lot of moisture.
Okay.
And most of the, again, I can't promise. It depends on how long this drought goes on. But most of the time, like a lot of the spring ephemerals, anything, the flowers that are spring bloomers and then die back in midsummer, they'll come back. Your other perennials, again, you're not listing what kind they are, so I don't know. I know certainly my perennials that are either native plants, especially prairie plants, or cultivars of prairie plants seem to be doing okay, but some of the others are struggling a little bit more, so you may even want to look at spot watering them. You know, we started the show with kind of what would we choose on our list, and of course this is all very personal, and I said, you know, for me it's trees and shrubs first, and then we talked maybe not lawns, but the next one I would put on are the perennials. Again, we have quite a bit of money invested in them, and they're perennial. They come back year after year. Now, there are, I know many of you that, and I should put the fruits in that also, because they're trees and they're shrubs, so most of the fruits will go in that category. Many of you may disagree, but for me, the vegetables are kind of a little bit lower on the priority list, and instead we can go to our favorite farmers market and get our local produce that way if we need to.
Right, yeah. And again, annual flowers.
Yeah, and annual flowers would definitely be the very lowest, I would think.
So make your list and work your way down it as well as you can. And I'm glad to hear that about the ferns, because my ferns are looking really dried up at this point.
And anything that likes really moist conditions are going to look bad first.
Right. Yeah. You know, we were talking earlier, Barb, that one of the things that's doing remarkably well in my garden is Turk's cap lilies, and they're not native. And they're blooming, even with this crazy amount of dryness that we've had. So yeah, that's been a real surprise for me.
They're kind of ditch-weed.
Yeah, they're.
So that's why they're...
They're pretty, though.
A lot of our weeds are doing very well. I mean, the only thing that's growing around the front in my along the road instead of... are the Queen Anne's lace that are coming up in the yard.
They're doing quite well around my house, too. Bob in Eau Claire has a question. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I've got you on speaker there. I'm off the speaker now.
Okay.
Great.
When we first moved into our residence here in Eau Claire about 5 years ago, the first thing we did was plant some trees in the front yard. Two of those trees were linden. Little did we know that linden trees are magnets for Japanese beetles. And so we've got, for the first time ever, I've got Japanese beetle traps out on the edge of the yard, and they're quickly filling up. But I noticed that the trees are still pretty plagued with the beetles. Now, it's one thing to shake off strawberry plants or something like that into soapy water. I'm aware of a product named Sevin, S-E-V-I-N, and I need to know before I use it. I do have it, but I haven't used it because I needed some expert advice. Will this harm the birds that are in our yard?
Well, let's back up a few things. First of all, I would not. Sevin is often recommended. Carbaryl is the generic name for it for control or management of Japanese beetle. I would not recommend its use on trees because you're spraying, even though they're only, 4 or 5 years old, again, they're still pretty good size. You don't want to be spraying trees like that. And the other problem with Sevin is that you have to repeat spray about every 7 days or even a little bit more often, depending on the label. So I wouldn't recommend it for your trees. The other thing is, I will say your neighbors are probably thanking you for having Japanese beetle traps in your yard because you're drawing all the Japanese beetles into your yard and out of their yards.
And I can say that Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist, often says that where you want the Japanese beetle traps is in the yards around you, not in your own.
Yeah, that's the old horticulture entomologist joke. You know, tell your neighbor down the street to put them in their yard so you don't have...
Because they actually, the traps attract them.
They attract them, and they will... Research after research after research shows that they attract more beetles to your yard than you would have if you didn't have the traps. If you have a really large yard, you know, half an acre, something like that, you can choose a sacrificial area and put the traps back there for them to draw them away from your garden or your linden trees and that kind of thing. So I would say most of the time, the lindens will survive. They will look awful, but they will survive. Okay?
Okay.
So don't do anything with them.
And get somebody down the street to put up a trap.
Yeah. I put it in the vacant lot.
Maybe you can buy them as presents for your neighbors.
Yes, gift wrap.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for that call, Bob. Now, I want to make sure that we acknowledge that not all of the state actually has been dealing with hot and dry conditions. In fact, quite the opposite. The northern part of the state, particularly the Superior area, had torrential rains not long ago. What kind of damage can that cause in our gardens, both in the immediate sense and, you know, what about longer term with possibly losing some of your good topsoil and things like that?
I don't know how much soil wash they had with the torrential rains. I haven't heard, because I'm not in that part of the state, and I haven't heard any reports. The damage usually for those kinds of things are the immediate damage, the wind damage to the trees. So all of those should have been pruned. Even trees like oaks, where we say don't prune in summertime, if you've had damage to them, they should be pruned. So you have a nice pruning cut. It heals better. The other concern is more of a food safety concern for anything that was flooded. And so our food safety specialists will talk about either not using some of that or very carefully washing it. And we have an excellent fact sheet by one of our food safety experts on the hort.uwex.edu website. And if you put flooded garden in the search box, it will come up. So that's really the best thing to do and just kind of keep an eye on things.
Now, what about if folks up in the northern part of the state are already dealing with a shorter growing season as it is? And then if they had, you know, lots of water that probably, you know, uprooted some of their vegetables and things like that, is it too late to replant things, or what things could they maybe squeak out a new batch of?
Well, they may want to look at a fall crop on some of their vegetables. And there are a lot of vegetables, and that maybe even in the southern part of the state, we're keeping our fingers crossed for a little bit cooler and more moisture, and then we can have fall crop vegetables. So there are things that can be planted, certainly back to broccoli, cauliflower, kohlrabi, chard, you know, spinach, lettuces that are the cool season that we plant usually in August or in the south. Even we can get away sometimes with early September.
Mm-hmm. And could we do some more successive plantings of beans this time?
You could, certainly. Okay.
And things like radishes.
Yeah, radishes like cool season, so those you're going to wait again. But certainly beans are really quick, especially if you're looking for one that has very short time between planting and harvest. Mm-hmm. So,
and are bush beans or pole beans shorter harvest time, or does it just depend?
I think it's usually bush beans that are shorter.
Okay.
So I would look for beans, I'm sure, would be one that you could get away with.
Great. All right. And Kate in Pewaukee is next. Hi, Kate.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a compost bin, one that sits on the ground, and you have to stir it every once in a while.
Uh-huh.
And when I went out to stir it, I saw that it had red ants, and they're big red ants, like 1/4 inch to 3/8 of an inch long. And I was wondering, well, first, I'm hesitant to use compost, you know, putting the ants out on my container garden. Can I spray poison in the bin?
No. Don't spray the...
You don't want to contaminate your compost.
No. Okay. And I would... You know, they're either going in there for some sort of food or something like that, or it may be because it's moist in there.
I was just
going
to say, they might actually be in there because it's the moistest spot in the garden.
But if you stir it up, really, I would turn it really well. They shouldn't have a nest in there. So that would be my biggest concern, is that they're building a nest, and you could destroy that by working it up really well.
And,
okay, because earlier... When I first was starting to plant my garden, one of my containers, I have great big containers, one of my containers had been taken over by black ants. They had set up their home in there, so I had dumped all that soil out and didn't use it again because I didn't want them back.
Yeah.
But... Yeah. Okay.
And I think ants really don't like it when wherever they've kind of set up camp gets disturbed.
Right.
So even just turning it over and mixing it up well, I'm guessing they might try to find some place that's a little less busy.
Yeah, they're going to go someplace else. They're not going to like what you're doing to them.
Okay.
Thanks, Kate. Uh-huh. Thanks for that call. And let's go next to Randy in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Randy. Hello. All right. And we had a question on the Facebook page. Susan says, for the past 3 years, my lupin have been devastated with aphids. Why have they continued to survive for 3 seasons? Is there anything I can do to control the pest without harming the other residents of my flower bed?
So I'm guessing she wants to know, is it why have the lupins?
I think so. I think how they've managed to survive.
Yeah, plants can survive lots of things, and aphids are certainly one of the things that they will often survive without any major problems. I would start watching those lupins really closely, since you know that this has been a problem year after year. And then I prefer to hose them down really well, or even if you want to use something a little bit stronger, I'd use an insecticidal soap. Test it on the lupins first. I wouldn't use it when it's this hot and dry.
Yeah.
I just use water. So I think they should be fine. Obviously, they've survived that long. They should continue to be okay.
And Marilyn from South Range posted a photo on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page of her azalea. It says, my azalea is being eaten by something. The leaves are just like strings. And in this photo, you can see that some of them are really just stripped to the vein. Will it come back next year? It's about 25 years old, and they in South Range have gotten plenty of rain this year.
And this may be earwigs.
Ah.
So it's not Japanese beetle damage mm-hmm. because they make lacy leaves.
Right.
Earwigs are the one I always think of when I see them chewed all the way down. Or I'm not familiar with a caterpillar that may eat them, mm-hmm. but that would be the other thing. This is probably one of those go out at night and investigate.
Right. So flashlight, 10 o'clock.
Right. And
go out
it
there
looks
and grab
like
one.
She's got it mulched, which I would right. also expect around an azalea. You could even kind of dig around in that mulch and
see if there's
something like that.
Lurking.
Yeah.
We are talking with Barb Larson, who's a horticulture educator for the UW Extension in Kenosha County. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk today. You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org. We are talking about helping our gardens survive the extreme weather that so many of us have been having around the state this year. Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. And I want to point out an article that we posted a link to on the Facebook page. It's called Water Your Plants that Barb wrote, and that is linked to the kenosha.uwex.edu website. Lots of great information there. And we really appreciate Barb and all the other UW Extension horticulture educators who spend time with us on Garden Talk, because the range of topics that you're able to offer advice on and answer questions is really wonderful, and I know we all appreciate it. Let's go to Paul in Cascade next. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. I have a question about African violets.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a retail source in southeast Wisconsin that actually grows them for sale, for retail sale?
You mean where they're propagating them in the store is propagating them?
Yes.
Not that I am aware of. That doesn't mean there isn't one, but I don't keep track of what all of these establishments do. So a lot of these, though, especially with something like African violet, they have been micropropagated or test tube propagated for a lot of years because of they want to reduce the amount of viruses mm-hmm. and other problems with them. So in many cases, they're getting in from a big grower that does that very specialized type of propagation and then grown out locally.
Well, okay. Perhaps another listener could say where they...
Maybe.
Quite possibly.
Or, you know, African violets are one of those where if you can find another gardener that grows African violets and you like it, that's a great source. The other is, and again, I don't know, so you may want to do an internet search or something. There are African violet societies.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, you know, and that would be a fabulous way to get African violets.
I actually get mine from the lady that cuts my hair.
There you go. See?
Hey, killing two birds with one stone.
That's the best local source.
There you go. Thanks for that call, Paul. And another potted plant question, an email from Nancy in Hartford. I have a potted hibiscus that was doing beautifully until about 10 days ago. Even with watering twice daily, a lot of leaves are turning yellow. It's facing south. Should I have it in part shade, even though it's a tropical plant? So maybe it sounds like a potted plant that's spending the summer outside.
Yeah, and it should be fine in the full sun if you've had it out in the full sun. But I think first of all, you may want to turn it. If they're turning yellow and you're watering a lot, have you been fertilizing?
Mm.
I always tell people, use your magic water checker, which stick your finger in the pot and see how wet it is and how far down. If you're overwatering, plants will also wilt and their leaves will turn mm-hmm. yellow. So sometimes overwatering looks like underwatering. So it's always tricky.
And we've talked actually recently about the fact that especially when we are watering more mm-hmm. in potted plants, especially, or, you know, container gardens, that you are washing a lot of those nutrients out because you do want to water deeply. So, you know, thinking about the combination of that fertilizing and watering, not just one or the other.
I think this is a little bit of investigation and you may want to check. And I'm assuming she's had it for a while. She has holes in the bottom of the pot, so she has good drainage on it.
All right. So. Well, good luck with that, Nancy. And Jenny in Tomahawk is next. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. I have a phenomenon that I would like, if you can explain it to me. I have grown cosmos in my garden, which started out to be 4 years ago or 5 years ago, was just yard. And I had it dug up, and I have grown flowers and vegetables mixed in together ever since.
That's great.
And I have only grown the cosmos that are in the pink or white variety.
Okay.
And they have, I planted them originally, and they come back every year, you know. They seed themselves, mm-hmm. and they come up like crazy.
Yeah.
And I have sometimes stuck new seeds in for a different color range or something, like when the new white fluffy ones came out, I stuck those in. And so I haven't planted any other kind. This year, cosmos came up like crazy, like they always do. And they're all got a dark center with the petals dark brownish red around the dark center and yellow around that. And they're cosmos.
Okay.
They don't look like anything I've ever had.
So basically,
I wonder, can they cross with coreopsis? I have coreopsis like crazy, too.
I don't think that they're crossing, although certain things will. Sometimes they're seed propagated. So there is a lot of genetic variation and what's called genetic drift, which means it changes from what it has been, and especially when we're looking at cultivars where they've been bred for a certain thing, sometimes after a few generations they'll shift on you or they'll change. And you're sure it's not that you're not getting up one of the other natives in there instead?
No. Okay. Nobody has any around me.
Okay.
They're all mine.
All right. Well, that sounds pretty too. They're not pink, but they're pretty.
So what is, should Jenny expect the same colors she's seeing this year, next year? Or?
I think you're just going to have, this is in the joy of gardening is surprise.
Just when you think you have it figured out. Well, Jenny, take some pictures of those gorgeous new flowers.
Okay, and could you tell me, you think that they've just, after so many years, 2 or 3 years, they've just gone back?
I think that may be what's going on.
Because they still look like cosmos.
Yeah, without seeing specifically what they are. Now, the other possibility, although you say they look like cosmos, they don't look like coreopsis, is that, you know, you've got seed coreopsis that have come up instead.
Oh, I have them, too.
Ah, okay.
But the leaves are quite different.
Yes,
you know,
yes, they are. Mm-hmm. So,
well, so you have a little genetic experiment going on out in the backyard, Jenny.
I would say, you know, it goes into, if you like them, keep them. If you don't, get rid of them.
All right. Well,
thank you.
Thanks for that, Jenny. And let's go to Alan in Jefferson. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Actually, I've listened to your show for a long time. This is the first time I ever got on, and I'm kind of a newbie at the whole green thumb thing, but I do have these few plants, just a normal regular palm, and I guess it's, my friend's mom said it was an exotic weed, but me, I think it's a plant. It's a succulent and it's a taproot, but I've never had this happen in the 3 or 4 years that I've had it. Even my palms, along with the other plant, is they're wilting. They're indoor plants. I use a coir-based, usually I say mulch, but it's not really a mulch. I use it. I got a dirt and perlite in there.
Okay. They're potting soil.
Yeah.
All right.
The succulent is, they're both slightly succulent.
Okay.
The taproot, it's, the leaves are turning red, but my palms are turning yellow. And I don't know what to do. Some people tell me I should change my coir, but I've been using the same. I mean, I just transplanted 3 months. I mean, I got some clues. I'm sorry, I don't want to run you around.
So you transplanted them about 3 months ago.
Yes, and they went perfect. And actually, I had my first flowering on this. I don't know, it's a weird plant.
And okay. All right.
Well, antennae that came out.
And I'm thinking you may want to check your watering and see, is it overwatering, is it underwatering? And if they don't look better, I would wouldn't think the potting soil would be a problem, but you may even want to repot them into a different potting soil. If they're all looking bad and you repotted all of them in the same potting soil, you know, sometimes things happen.
There could have been some contamination.
Yeah, I don't know. So you may want to try that. But plants, even indoor plants, because of the light conditions changing and everything, the watering regime will change. And especially if you've transplanted them recently, it takes a while for them to reestablish that root system after transplant.
Okay. Now, if somebody mentioned something about a salt or a sodium salt lock, and it's depriving the plants of food, could that be it?
Well, if you put them, if you've repotted in new clean potting soil, that's not a problem. It tends to happen if you're using tap water over a long period of time, especially if it's soft tap water, and then you'll get some salt buildup. You also can get that from fertilizers, but with where you've just transplanted, that shouldn't be it.
All right. Good luck with that, Alan. And I wanted to mention that Dave from Monroe says about the red ants and the compost. He recommends spreading cornmeal over the compost. The ants will carry it back to their nests and die.
Oh, okay.
So not great for the ants, but good for the compost. It's Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry while he is enjoying the gardens and garden shows of England. Barb Larson, our guest, a horticulture educator for the UW Extension in Kenosha County. When things are going well in the garden, it's a real pleasure. But when insects, diseases, or the weather are on the attack, it can be difficult to know what to do and how to take care of it. We have a great group of horticulture educators working with the UW Extension throughout the state, and several of them spend time talking with us on Garden Talk a few times a year. Barb Larson is a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. She has a wealth of information to share, and we're always happy when she can join us on Garden Talk. Barb, thanks again for spending time with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And as always, we have lots of people waiting to talk with you, so let's go right back to the phones and Peggy in Menominee Falls. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, I have a question about May apples.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a wildflower sale the day before Mother's Day, and I bought a whole bunch of stuff, Jack in the Pulpit, May apple, trilliums. And I planted them, and they were all thriving. But before the dry, hot weather started, the May apples kind of shriveled up, I mean, withered and turned brown. And I just wondered if that's a natural part of the life cycle.
Yeah, they are a spring, what's called a spring ephemeral. So they're a native plant, and they, especially as we start to get to midsummer and especially on drier years, they will turn yellow, and they should pop right back up next spring.
Oh, good. Okay. And then the trilliums and the Jack in the Pulpit have now almost disappeared.
Yep,
I can't even find them to water them. They'll be okay, too?
Yeah, they should be. I think it's these kinds of things are hard for me to actually tell you some precise kind of recommendations because this year is so bizarre. And they're newer plants. So if we go on long, long periods of dry, if we continue for another 2 or 3 weeks, you may want to do a little bit of watering in that area. And besides which, you're in an area where you have to have trees. If you've got them planted, they've got to be in shade.
Yeah.
So, you know, you really should think about watering those trees.
So you can do double duty.
So then that'll take care of it.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thanks, Peggy. And those are all really lovely native plants.
Oh, yeah.
To
they're
have
beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Too. Let's go to Kathy in Whitelaw next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have two Norway maple trees that are cracking at the Y where the two branches split. These trees are about 30 feet tall, and we planted them maybe about 10 years ago. I'm wondering why they're cracking, and it's going all the way down to the ground with the crack.
Okay.
Are you giving me any kind of could you give me some kind of advice what to do? We were thinking about taking a bolt and putting it right through the tree so we can save it, but I don't know.
No. Is it on the south or west side of the trunk that it's doing this?
On the west side.
Yeah. Sounds like winter injury. So there's, you could have, it could be superficial where it's just the bark that's cracked. And the best thing is just leave it alone. If it's going deeper in, which some of the frost cracks will go deeper in, you may see on these trees that they kind of open up every winter and then close every summer as the wood swells and
just like a door.
Contracts, just like a door, yeah. And it will be there forever. It really won't complete. It'll heal a little bit, but it may not heal completely.
Okay.
But you really, there's not much you can do about them.
All right.
And definitely, you know, if it gets a lot worse, you could have a certified arborist look at it, but don't do anything like that yourself. Don't wrap anything around it. It won't help.
And that could be a risk for disease and insects too.
Right.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Great. Okay. Good luck with those trees, Kathy. And don't forget to water them, as we've been hearing today, too. We had an email from Audrey in Onalaska. She says, I had a very strange thing happen this year with my established strawberry patch. The plants simply did not grow. Is this likely a result of the warming and cooling we had in March? Now the plants seem to have dried up and died.
Yeah, I'm wondering if they did start out really early and then we had that cold snap.
Right.
And strawberries, quite often, you know, we do usually mulch those in wintertime. So it could be that they got some cold damage in them.
Well, and also she says it's an established strawberry patch. That's not the easiest thing to say, actually. Established strawberry patch. How long do strawberries, I mean, they don't go on forever, right? They need to be replaced how many years?
And actually, there is a system where you go through with a patch renewal. You allow if it's a traditional strawberry, you allow the daughter plants to grow out, and then you end up tilling up and destroying the original mother plants and allowing the daughters to grow. We do have a really good booklet on growing strawberries in Wisconsin on the Learning Store site. And you may want to look at that. You can actually even just open it up and read through it.
That's the UW Extension Learning Store. And I have to say, it's not surprising how often the Learning Store's publications come up on Garden Talk, because there are so many great publications on just about everything you can imagine garden related.
Right. Right.
Great. And so that's always a great resource.
And especially for the fruits and vegetables. There's a lot of really good ones.
Let's go to Barb in Oshkosh next. Hi, Barb.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Oh, what a great show. I'm just learning so much all the time here.
Great.
All right, there's my problem. I have these wonderful, beautiful cosmos that I've had forever, and I love them, and they're huge, beautiful plants. And something has happened to them this year that I've never seen in my whole life. Some of the individual flowers on the cosmos plants are getting a green thing growing in the middle, like a tuft.
Yep.
What is that?
Well, this is one of Brian Huddleston's diseases. It sounds like it's probably aster yellows. And it will cause this weird kind of distorted growth kind of thing where it looks really spiky and everything.
Yeah, that's awful.
Yeah, it is awful. I would... there's really not anything you can do about it. So we do have a very nice fact sheet on it on the hort.uwex.edu that Brian wrote on it. You may want to even take a picture and take it into your local extension office and have them confirm what it is. But that's what it sounds like to me.
What can you give me the name of it?
Aster yellows.
Aster?
A-S-T-E-R. Oh. Yeah, cosmos are in the aster or sunflower family.
Oh, they are.
Mm-hmm.
And are there other flowers that might be affected by that other than aster, sunflowers, cosmos?
Yeah, any of those. We also find them show up sometimes in the carrot family. So there's some different ones that they can be a problem in.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Barb. And is that something that we need to get rid of the plants?
Yeah,
if they have
it? Have to get rid of them.
Okay,
yeah.
Good to know. Email from Susie in Madison. I have marigolds in a half whiskey barrel and the chipmunks keep digging them up. Is there something available to put in the dirt to keep them out? They don't seem to bother the clay pot of marigolds right next to the whiskey barrel. Maybe there's a little scent of whiskey to it.
I don't know.
But is there something to keep chipmunks from?
Not that I know of. You could, you know, put a kind of temporary fence around it or cover them temporary, you know, discourage them and have them go someplace else. But otherwise, I don't know.
Chipmunks are really quite the scourge, and they can get around about everything.
Yeah. So. I've kind of gotten rid of my chipmunks. I have greyhounds.
There you go. Yeah, I was going to say perhaps a cat.
A cat would do it.
But it is funny that she's saying that they prefer the whiskey barrel, but maybe it's just
maybe they can climate or something.
Maybe it's easier to get into.
I don't know.
Oh, well, sorry about that,
yeah,
Susie.
Yeah, I don't have a good recommendation. Yeah. On
and
that
Gary in La Crosse asks, are stink bugs from the East Coast coming here? Do we need to worry about our gardens?
Yes, we are worried about stink bugs showing up here. And we're talking about there are already stink bugs here. But I think what he's talking about is what's called the brown marmorated stink bug, which Phil Pelletieri's probably talked about.
He's on the case, I think.
Yeah. And so we're watching, we're keeping our fingers crossed because they will not only do a tremendous amount of damage to our fruits, our vegetables, and other plants, they're also will come in the house in the wintertime. Ooh. So,
and if I remember correctly, there's concern about, I think it's the soybean crop in Wisconsin that the stink bugs might be.
Oh, could
a
be.
Risk
I haven't
for.
Heard that. See, I don't do agronomy. Yeah. So,
and Mary says on Facebook, our sweet corn is growing tassels. Is this too early? Should we cut them off?
No.
It's right about right.
Yeah, I was going to say usually. And remember everything because we've had so much heat. A lot of our plants are still 3 to 4 weeks ahead. So, no, that if you cut the tassels off, you won't have any sweet corn.
That's basically like snipping off the buds on a flower plant, right?
Yeah, and we'll hope it cools off so that they actually will pollinate decently.
All right, and Matthew in Summit Lake has a corn-related question, so let's go there. Hi, Matthew.
Hi there, everybody. Great show. Gotta love public radio. I have a question regarding some popcorn, actually. I try to grow something new every year, and this year is popcorn. I tried to grow it in a elevated bed.
Okay.
The 13 round line ground squirrels decided that I wasn't going to be able to grow any popcorn there, so they ate it all. But I thought they ate it all, so I planted some Roma tomatoes and some carrots in there instead.
Okay.
Now they're supposed to coexist quite happily, but then I read in the Vegetable Gardener's Bible that corn and the tomatoes don't get along at all. Now, I only have maybe 6 to 8 stalks of popcorn coming up. It's maybe a foot or so high. Do I transplant that? Do I just let it rip, or do I take it over the ground?
Corn doesn't transplant well, so and I've never heard that corn and tomatoes have a problem with each other, except that, you know, they're both pretty good-sized plants, so that they would use a lot of the nutrients and water and those kinds of things. But, you know, the companion planting stuff really is more what people are fun kinds of things,
right,
rather than research proven. So I wouldn't be concerned about that. My biggest concern is you don't have very much popcorn, and corn has to be grown in pretty good sized blocks and numbers of plants
for pollination
purposes. So I don't think that you'd really get good pollination on it.
I have other beds of it around.
Oh, okay. All right. Then that wouldn't be a problem then.
So, it could grow.
Yeah. If you have other beds and you've got enough, then you may want to get it out of there anyway.
Yeah.
Just because why have that in there if you've got the tomatoes?
And if they're going to shade the tomatoes, especially.
Yeah, that would be the only other thing I could think of that may be a problem. So they're competing with the tomatoes, but are they really a problem with tomatoes? Not that I know of.
All right. Good luck with that, Matthew. Hope your corn doesn't pop prematurely given the hot weather. And Chris in Green Bay is next. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm thrilled with you guys. You do such a nice job.
Oh, thank you.
I have a question. Actually, I thought of another one, too. But my question is about fertilizing during this time of heat and dryness. I have a pretty large container garden, and I don't want to be forcing those flowers to bloom if they should be kind of just laid back and relaxing.
Okay. Well, fertilizer actually forces more leaf development than flowers. So that would be one of the things you need to think about. But we were talking about earlier, you mentioned these are container plants. So that means you're watering all the time. When you water in containers, you wash out the nutrients. So you really should fertilize them. You may want to use what I just did with my container plants is half strength in water And I fertilized them about a week ago. And boy, they really took off and look pretty good. But I am keeping them regularly watered.
Okay. Now, what about shrub roses, clematis, perennials in the ground?
I would not do those. And in fact, once we get to midsummer, I don't like to fertilize any of my perennials. And most perennial flowers and trees and shrubs don't need regular fertilization. As long as you've got them in pretty good soil and you mulch them or put compost around them, they don't need fertilization.
Yeah, they got sheep manure this year.
Oh, well, then they definitely don't need to be fertilized.
And you had another question too, Chris?
Yes, I have a couple of clematis that are just going nuts. I have a lot of them, but there are a couple that are just really unruly. Is it too late to cut back?
Depends on the kind of clematis, because clematis, yeah, this is not an easy answer, as you might think it is. Clematis are basically divided into three different categories based on the time they bloom, and that's how what type they are, and that will then affect when they are pruned, whether they're pruned, and how much you prune them back.
In my garden, the varmints chop them off in the winter.
Uh-huh.
Regardless, they don't read those little charts.
Yeah. How about that? Isn't that amazing? And they come back and they're fine, right?
Yeah.
Which means...
they do. I probably don't get the spring bloom that I would like on some of them. But, you know, I've used hardware fence up a couple of feet. They just climb the hardware fence.
Yeah,
sure.
Any of the late summer, fall blooming clematis, like sweet autumn clematis, and I've got another one that right off the top of my head, I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, they're late summer bloomers, and those really can be, as you're describing, cut back way back. But they're generally cut way back in the early spring. Or I guess you could do them in the late fall, but I wouldn't do them now.
No, I'm talking about they're just way, some of them are just way overgrowing their trellis.
Yeah, but I still wouldn't trim now. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're just...
Just let it go for now.
Yeah, this is extra stress. Yeah, let's just let these plants alone and let them struggle as they can. Let's not add extra to them.
Okay.
All right.
I was thinking, well, you can cut back roses until... you know, the beginning of August, and that's a month away. But then I didn't think about the stress factor.
Yeah, right.
All right. Thanks for that call, Chris. And I want to let everyone know that they are listening to the wonderful advice and knowledge of Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. Barb comes by a few times a year to share her knowledge and expertise with us. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on Garden Talk. And let's go to John in Green Bay. Sticking with the Green Bay calls. Hi, John.
Yes. My first question is going to be in regards to, is it a good idea when you have a container that has been overwatered, and this doesn't work on clay, but of course plastic pots, let's say everything is too tight, your soil's too tight. Take that old pot, both hands, slap it on one, you know, give it a good slap on the sides, spin it around about 180 degrees and give it a couple good slaps with the palms of your hands to loosen that soil up. Good idea, just to get air down there. And then also I want to make a comment about controlling chipmunks.
Okay. No, I can't see that's going to get air in it. If you've got it where your potting soil has gotten to the point where it's old enough that it's starting to collapse or you're calling it too tight, I would repot in a new good quality potting soil, increase the size of the pot slightly.
In fact, just thinking about kind of like when you're trying to fit, you know, a little more sugar into a canister or something, you tap the sides to get rid of air and it gets even more compacted,
it would.
Right?
Exactly. If you'd have any space, it would make it worse. You're right.
Mm-hmm. And on the chipmunks.
Yeah.
Yep.
Found that get some Milorganite. Once everything is planted in either containers or beds, sprinkle some of that Milorganite around the perimeter of either the pot or the flower bed.
Oh, okay. That's a new one. I haven't heard that.
Thanks. All right. Well, thanks. We'll get the chipmunk report from everyone because I'm sure anyone who's got chipmunk problems is pretty desperate for a
And everybody an has different ideas of what works. So.
It's really, it's really tricky. Let's see here. Let's go next to Cheryl in Superior. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I have a question about cutworms.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They've been really bad this year. We're going to have lots of them.
It's been really bad. This has been a big cut worm year.
And is that cyclic? Are they going to go away and hibernate sometime?
Will they go away? Yes, they will. They will eventually. I mean, they'll eventually pupate or go into their cocoons, and you get adults and that kind of thing. We're just getting, especially for central Wisconsin and farther north, we're just getting lots of reports of cutworms. So it just seems to be the year for them. Patient. Next year, who knows? I find that over time, insect problems tend to be cyclic. So,
okay.
And as we were talking earlier, we've seen lots of earwigs this year. We've seen lots of flea beetles this year.
Yeah.
Do we know what we're looking at for Japanese beetles this year? Is it too early to tell?
It's still too early to tell. And it's, from what I'm hearing, it's down a little bit, but we don't know for sure. I think we're going to have to wait another couple of weeks on the Japanese beetles.
All right. All right. Thanks for that call, Cheryl. And Nancy in Oconomowoc. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. Already I have an answer for my first question, but my second question for compost, is it okay to put ashes from a wood-burning fireplace into your compost heap for a vegetable garden?
It's okay in small amounts if it's regular wood. You're not burning anything else in there.
And probably, well, I don't think you'd want to be burning treated wood anyway. For many reasons,
right.
But you definitely don't want that in
Right. So think about how much you're adding. It's very alkaline. So you can, if you put too much in, could actually throw off the pH of the compost. And let's see, you're in Oconomowoc, which means you have kind of higher pH soils anyway. So we really don't want to raise the pH of that compost.
Okay, so just moderately use the ashes.
Yeah, I would say moderate to small amounts. And you will have to add, I would say, a lot of green matter to it to kind of balance it off, too.
Like weeds, like radish tops and that kind of thing?
Yeah, that would work. Oh, and the other is it soaks, it will
get
wet.
Or some of that purslane that everybody's got.
Yeah, some of that purslane. Good idea, Judith. That would work.
And you were saying you also want to make sure that there's moisture.
Yeah, moisture, and you mix it up really well with the other stuff.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you.
And we actually had an email from Sue asking how to make compost tea. She has a compost bin, but she doesn't know how to make the tea for fertilizing the garden.
Well, I would say I can tell you how to make it, but I wouldn't go through all that work because we're not showing that it's really adding that many nutrients. You're just the best thing is just work that compost in, and then you get other benefits too.
Right.
If you really want to do it, you get like a burlap sack or something like that. You put the compost in that, and then you put it in a 50-gallon or, really big barrel of water.
Right. So basically you're making a big tea bag.
And, exactly.
But going for the lazy person's approach, which
is mine.
Which is, there's a lot to be said for. If you spread, well-mixed compost and well-composted compost, if you just kind of top dress with it, won't it kind of make a tea as you water, as it rains and things like that? Will the nutrients get in, or do you really need to mix it into the soil?
No, it will as it decomposes, plus things like insects and earthworms and that kind of thing will also move it down. So
great.
And then you get the benefits of adding that organic matter to the soil.
Great. Well, we have less than a minute left, but just to kind of recap, Barb, so people should be watering those trees?
Water trees,
water shrubs. Also, water things that may have died back on the top, but you want to keep the roots going. Prioritize the things that you want to try to make it through to next year. Anything else? Is mulching good?
Mulching is good. Okay. It helps hold that moisture in, helps prevent it from getting really hot and dry. So continue with all those kinds of things. Don't fertilize, don't press it, just kind of limp them all through.
Barb Larson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha County. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Monday at 11, I'll be broadcasting from our Milwaukee studios, talking about fitness and staying safe in hot weather when we're trying to stay fit and active, and also talking about refreshing summer wines with Jessica Bell. She's from mywineschool.com on the Ideas Network.
I know one doctor who still makes house calls. Join us every week for Zorba Pasture on Your Health. You'll get down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips. like this tasty recipe for
tuna salad pitas.
We always have a great time, so will you, Saturday morning at 8 and Saturday afternoon at 1, here on the Ideas Net.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Rockweiler Insulation, a family-owned